I will open the Senate Rules Committee for February 10th, 2009. We are going to start off with the public hearing on SJR 15. Will the committee administrator please give a brief report?
Yes. Senate Joint Resolution 15 would honor President Lincoln by declaring him honorary territorial governor for Oregon for February 12th, 2009. And we have statements from revenue and fiscal stating no revenue impact and no fiscal impact for this measure.
That's an assured way to, as long as the measure is not controversial, to get it passed this session. No fiscal, no revenue. Senator Farrow, did you want to?
Briefly, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think the bill is sponsored by every member of the Senate. It's one of those situations where, in connection with the sesquicentennial celebration, it's kind of an intriguing thing to note that there are direct connections between Oregon as a territory and Oregon as a state and Abraham Lincoln. And the whole concept that we had seen President Zachary Taylor offer Abraham Lincoln the territorial government, governorship of the territory of Oregon in 1849. And my understanding, at least it's an anecdote, that he at least considered the possibility of becoming the Oregon territorial government. And there's no question that history would have perhaps treated Abraham Lincoln differently and may have come to a complete a change in direction. He might never have been president of the United States, or who knows what his or Oregon's eventual fate might have been had he accepted the territorial governorship. But the idea that it is an intriguing thing, at least to contemplate that on our 150th anniversary of statehood, that we resolve that Abraham Lincoln should be the territorial governor for at least one February 12, 2009. And Mr. Chairman, I had to explain to my colleagues on the Senate floor when I solicited their support as chief sponsors for this legislation that I would do anything to get a Republican governor in the state of Oregon.
Even if you have to exhume him.
even to the point of electing him. A great man who's not been with us for about 150 years. But so, Mr. Chairman, I commend the Senate Joint Resolution to our members and hope we can pass it with a unanimous vote from the committee and from the Senate floor when it comes. I believe it comes to the floor Saturday, does it not? Isn't that the idea to bring it?
We're working on it.
Working on it.
Yeah, hope we can get there. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Burton, would you like to come forward? And please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Mike Burton. I'm the chairman of the Oregon Lincoln Bicentennial Commission. I want to thank Senator Ferrioli and his staff for helping us with this. There is a companion bill in the House, HJR 8, which is exactly mirrors this, and hopefully we can see both of those passed. Senator Ferrioli, I think, fairly stated the question, probably Lincoln's most famous connection to Oregon is he, after the, when he served his one term in Congress, after which he decided not to run for re-election because he found it very unsatisfactory, as he said, serving in that body, and decided to pursue more of his other side of his law practice. But he was offered by the Zachary Taylor administration the territorial governorship of Oregon. And it is said that it is he turned it down because his wife didn't want to pack her family and go way out there. I think he probably did it more for good political reasons because he was looking really, Lincoln was a good politician. He knew he had some ambition and he knew where he wanted to go. And coming into Oregon at those days wouldn't have served him that well. But once he took office as president, there are a lot of Lincoln links to that. I've given you some information about that. 11 of our 36 counties in Oregon have direct ties to Lincoln or some association with him. And he had an impact, not geographically, but also with some of the laws. In his first year in office in 1862, he signed the Homestead Act. He had urged that to be passed, which opened up land here for settlers. He was a supporter and urged the passage of the Morrell Land Grant Act, which set up the agricultural land grant colleges and led to Oregon State in this particular state. And he supported the and signed the Pacific Railroad Act in 1862 also, which was the final legislation that allowed the Transcontinental Railroad to occur. So he was it's a lot of things that Lincoln did in while he was in the presidency, besides the things we usually think about, and that's pursuing the Civil War. I've given you some information. It's in this booklet. This is the National Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Commemorative Book. It is, I think some of you have already noted this, it is a collector's item, particularly if you look at page 100. You'll know why. But it is, it does give you some information, and all the states are listed in there. And I hope, I very much appreciate the committee's attention to this. If the actual birthday is on Thursday, ideally, we'd have these on the floor. You mentioned, I think, Saturday, but if you could get this through on the 12th, which is the actual birthday, that would be terrific. Similar legislation is being passed in the state of Washington, Idaho, and in Montana, which is those are the states that made up the old Oregon Territory. And so we're trying to sort of manage logistics on this to try to have them all passed on the same day in all of those states with that legislature. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer those.
Yes. Any questions? Yes. Senator Atkins.
Thank you. A couple of questions. Number one is, can I have two more of these?
As long as we don't pass the ethics value mark, I don't know.
Ron, can I have two more of these?
Yes, Senator, certainly you can.
Can you recommend a bibliography? I see there's in this, it's really great, but there's two, there's a page on here, some more famous Lincoln books that have been out. But in Oregon, I have not been able to find a volume that describes the friendship of Lincoln and Baker, other than anecdotes here and there. Is there a book, to your knowledge, that more clearly that addresses that friendship at all?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Axon, I should have pointed out, I'm going to ask one of those individuals to come up here. I have a couple other members of the commission here with me. We're actually conducting some town hall meetings around the state. We had one in Baker City. Senator Arioli's helped us with that one there because of that connection with Edward Baker, who was his best friend. The members of the commission that are back here, is Illinois Doug Tracy, who's a musician, he actually found the sheet music from Lincoln's campaign songs in 1860-1864 and has published them the first time they've been recorded. He's here with us. Dr. Elliot Trommel, who is a lecturer on Lincoln, is here, and Dr. Tony Walk, who is an author, has written some fictional books about Lincoln. But if I could ask Dr. Dick Etulain to come up for a minute, he is probably more familiar with the bibliographical information and Lincoln in the West. Dick?
Two books for you.
Can you give your name for the...
Okay, record? Dick Etulain is my name. First book... Robert W. Johansson, J-O-H-A-N-N-S-E-N.
Hold on.
Okay.
Start over. I didn't have my pen out.
Okay.
Robert who?
Robert W. Johansson.
That's it.
J-O-H-A-N-N-S-E-N.
Uh-huh.
It's the frontier on before Civil War. See, the frontier conflict before the Civil War. And it's a study of Oregon country in the 1850s and 60s. It has quite a bit on Baker. Then there is a biography of Baker. And I can only give you the second author's name, Tarshish, T-A-R-S-H-I-S. And it's called, the title is Lincoln's Constant Ally. And it's about Edward Baker, published by the Oregon Historical Society.
Dr. Etulain has published about 40 books of his own.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You can say, I'm sure that Powell's books is about to make a bunch of money off your testimony.
Anything else?
I will mention for those of you who, since Senator Atkinson brought this up, Senator Edward Baker was the, when the state was established in 1859, there were two senators, Senator Lane and Senator Baker. Senator Baker was a Republican senator, first one elected on the West Coast. He was a very close friend of Lincoln's. In fact, one of Lincoln's sons was named after Edward Baker. Baker introduced Lincoln at his first inaugural, which I think in those days simply said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the president-elect." That was the introduction, brief speech. But he then volunteered when the war broke out. He'd been in the Mexican War, and he volunteered. He wanted generalcy, as I understand, but the word went that if you took a generalcy, you'd have to resign your Senate seat, so he took a colonelcy instead. So he was a sitting senator, and he was killed at the Battle of Ball's Bluff. He was the only sitting U.S. senator to ever be killed in battle. So I'd suggest that all of you not do that.
Well, anything else? Any additional questions? I would point out that in 1859, and Senator Farioli will be playing one of them on Saturday, there were actually only two Republicans in the Senate.
And the one of the Republicans became president of the Senate twice.
Yes. Yes.
Nice.
The one you're playing.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anything else? Why don't you do the honors?
Oh, thank you, Mr. President.
Yeah, I'll move. Close public hearing, open work session.
Mr. Chairman, I move SJR 15 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay. SJR 15 has been moved to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Only this, Mr. Chair, there was a public television special that they've been running on Lincoln. His life, the assassination, and the effects of the Lincoln presidency on the country. And one of the observations was made I really think is rather profound. There probably has been no American president that is so personally touched as many Americans as President Lincoln has. And his legacy is alive and present in virtually everything that we do. And I think that the proof of that is that in the publication that was distributed to the members, national leaders are still associating themselves in a personal way with the president. So it's, I think, fully appropriate that we take a moment to recognize the profound impact that Lincoln has on virtually everyone, even to this day, and confer the honor of appointing him as the territorial governor of the state of Oregon for a day.
Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, motion passes. Senator Farioli, will you carry?
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on all three measures, SB 30, SB 31, and SB 32. The purpose of this public hearing is largely to hear public testimony both on those measures and on any amendments that are before the committee. We distributed a series of amendments on Tuesday. I believe they are all available. I believe Senator Metzger has brought an additional amendment today that he would like the committee to at least consider. I think we haven't had time to review the amendment that you brought forward. Were copies made available to the public of that amendment if they see it?
Do you have copies? Brian, can you put copies of the DACLA? Okay.
So, let's see. I do have a sign-up sheet here somewhere. So we will go ahead and get started. One of the things that I should identify for people that are here is it's the chair's intent to open this up again for another public hearing on Thursday just to get general testimony. But on Thursday, there is a clear potential that we will have a floor session in the Senate. And this committee may find itself either shortened significantly or canceled. So that other hearing would have to be delayed to a later date. Okay, I have three people for a panel. I think I'll just bring them all up first. Paul Winberg.
Who's it?
Greg Phillips. And Jeff Hawthorne. Just Hawthorne. It's interesting. I'm trying to put the connections here, and soon we'll find out. These are all people representing performing arts and actually other arts, and this is the first testimony we've had on ethics reform from anyone from that sector. So please start out. Mr. Winberg, why don't you start out? Or whichever
actually,
order you'd like to go
yeah,
in.
Yeah, we're great. Actually prepared to
we have a rehearsed order.
Okay.
Chair Devlin and members, thank you very much for having the arts community here today to talk about Senate Bill 30 and an array of amendments that are for your consideration this morning.
Can you please identify?
For the record, yes. My name is Jeff Hawthorne. I am the Director of Community Affairs at the Regional Arts and Culture Council, or RAC. RAC is the steward of public investments in arts and culture for the Portland Tri-County area, including Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. So Senate Bill 10 made some major revisions to the state ethics law, and when it lowered the annual gift limit from $100 to $50 and banned gifts of entertainment to public officials, it created far-reaching consequences for the art for the artists and arts organizations in the Portland area and throughout the state. For us at RAC, this bill has been problematic for three reasons. First, most arts organizations rely on both public and private funding to support their missions. So when dealing with donors or other supporters, it is customary to issue a certain number of complimentary tickets to those arts events or a dress rehearsal or a premiere. Some of those invitations are extended to public officials in the community who are also required to monitor how the public funds have been spent on these arts organizations. It's important to understand that public officials covered by the ban are more than just elected officials and their staff. They're also the program managers at an organization like the Regional Arts and Culture Council, who are the stewards of these public investments. So if we are unable to go and evaluate these performances without further payment, that would be like having someone from the Secretary of State's Audit Division have to pay to go into a contractor's office to see if public funds are being spent accordingly. In our region, this affects, as I mentioned earlier, the city of Portland, the three counties, also metro, and universities in the region who are working to partner with these arts organizations. So if the organizations cannot provide these tickets on a complimentary basis, then either the public officials do not attend the performance, or they must pay full price, which essentially means that the taxpayer is paying twice for the same performance, and certainly we don't want that. The second problem is that for public arts organizations, if serving on their board makes someone a public official for the purposes of this law, then it makes it more difficult to recruit and retain private individuals to serve as the board members who advance the missions of these organizations. And thirdly, since the law applies to tens of thousands of Oregonians, once you count all of the public officials and their relatives and the people they live with, it's making it very difficult for arts organizations to determine whether they can give any complimentary tickets in their for their performances. So we are here today to ask that the Senate clarify that arts organizations can provide entertainment to public officials if it is clearly within their scope of the official duties to attend these performances. And also we ask you to eliminate the distinction between entertainment and other types of gifts. Thank you.
Chair Devlin and committee members, thank you and good morning. My name is Paul Winberg. I'm the executive director of the Eugene Symphony Association in Eugene, Oregon. Our organization serves about 27,000 children and adults each year, not only through symphonic performances, but we have quite a large education and community engagement suite of programs that encompasses all kinds of activities from the more traditional youth concerts to pre-concert lectures, and then we have many, many partnerships with the 4J School District, Springfield School District, the University of Oregon, Arts Umbrella, which is the Eugene Youth Symphony. The list goes on and on, and something we're very proud of. We're here, or I'm here, actually, on behalf of arts organizations, basically to reiterate what's just been talked about by my colleague, Jeff. Just one additional example, I think, to what we're looking for, and again, we're proposing that you consider eliminating the distinction between entertainment and every other type of gift. Right now, it's just simply confusing, and as a result of the language, which is part of SB 30, I think a lot of arts groups have just sort of stepped away from even trying to engage public officials, elected officials, in what it is that we're doing, and we believe what we're doing is critical, a critical aspect of what's happening within each of our communities. Just as an example, the Eugene Symphony relies on private and public support to fulfill its mission. And we do believe, as I said before, that we're an important cultural and economic resource for our community. But more than that, our artists are employees whose product is the musical experience. And our product, again, is our performances. However, the symphony is prohibited from inviting public officials to tour our factory floor, so to speak, as an example, through an invitation to a complimentary dress rehearsal or a premiere performance. A similar prohibition does not exist for other entities that receive public funds, say, for example, are the local Lane Community College, which may invite public officials to showcase a workplace development or any other type of activity. So again, we believe the current language is just simply too restrictive, too overreaching, has created confusion for most arts organizations, and we would, again, propose that you consider eliminating that distinction between entertainment and every other type of gift.
I also would like to thank Chair Devlin and the committee for taking the time to hear from us this morning and visit with us. I'm Greg Phillips. I'm the executive director of Portland Center Stage. Portland Center Stage is now the fourth largest arts organization in the state after the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, the Oregon Symphony, and the Portland Art Museum. Our home, as you probably know, is the Girding Theater at the Armory, which was the first and continues to be the only building in America that is on the National Register of Historic Places and has a platinum LEED rating from the United States Green Building Council. Our facility is one that has become a great center for the community and for the region, and we are not only seeing some upwards of 150,000 people attending performances, but another 40 or 50,000 people each season coming to the facility to have their events, their nonprofit special events, fundraisers, visits, off-site meetings, and so forth. And we're welcoming guests from literally all around the world to find out what it is we're doing and how it is we're doing it. We are, in addition to one of the 20 largest American theater companies now, and have that sort of respect from our field. We are also thought of by our peers nationally as at the forefront of civic engagement in the unique ways that we've discovered to reach out to our community, to our students, and to bring them into our space and share that space and share the arts with them. One of the challenges that we have, as you can imagine during these times, is the times that we're in. We're not here asking for either a bailout or an economic stimulus package, though as you probably know, the arts are struggling. We are told that 10% of our not-for-profit organizations and arts organizations will no longer be with us during the course of this year. That means that there are communities everywhere that are going to be unfortunately negatively impacted because those services will no longer be available and provided. Specifically, you've heard from Jeff and Paul as to our concerns related to the amendment and how we hope that you will make change to make it better. I would tell you that in our program, in addition to the performances that we provide, that we invite all of you to join us for, we do an extensive outreach program where we bring students to the theater, classrooms full of students. We invite schools. We do follow-up programs with them. We go to the schools. We try and consistently entertain, educate, and inspire students. There is such a need for this today because, as we all know, there is not enough arts education available in the schools, and we're trying to provide a valuable additional service. One of the things that has become confusing in the current prohibition of entertainment under the gift limit is that of donated tickets. Under the broad definitions of public official and the scope of legislative or administrative interest, it raises the question of how and to whom the theater and other cultural organizations may even donate tickets within the community. For example, many cultural organizations support significant outreach programs within local school districts. These programs are highly valued and important cultural resources, often not otherwise offered, as I mentioned, through K-12 public education. Yet these types of programs are prohibited to those students who have unfortunate circumstance of being related to a public official with an administrative interest. That could be the children of a board member, a city, county, or state member, or even program managers of another cultural funding entity. Current definitions make it difficult to determine how cultural organizations can effectively and fairly invest in their community through these types of programs and donated or reduced price tickets. I will tell you a specific example that comes to mind. I'm very familiar with a part-time state employee, a single mom with two children, having a very difficult time raising her kids, and we're not able, if we would choose, to let her children or that family be our guests along with other families in need because of that connection. And I think you would all agree with everything else we're doing at this time and the uphill battle we're all fighting to try and reach out, uplift people's spirits, inspire people, educate both sides of the brain. In all fairness, we want to get all of the community to be able to access our performances and our educational programs. We'd be more than happy to take questions or answer any questions that you might have about any of this.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Winberg, Mr. Phillips, or Mr. Hawthorne?
Yes.
Senator Farioli.
I think we're going to need your help in crafting an amendment because the definitions are difficult. The ban on entertainment, I think, came from some outrage over gifts that included attendance at the Blazer skyboxes and, you know, other sort of performance art, arguably, or sporting events or other entertainment spectacles that considered by some to be excessive. You know, if you compared the value of an attendee's expenses at one of the Blazers playoffs games, it could come into the hundreds or even thousands of dollars. And, you know, that has to also be compared with some of the public offerings that you might see at the Ashlands Shakespearean Festival. We were all guested at various times to come and have a brush with culture in Ashland. You know, always a memorable experience, but arguably a gift nonetheless. And on down to the idea that an elected public official's child couldn't go with a babysitter to the zoo. Because it's entertainment. So, you know, some of these things are extreme. Some seem relatively ridiculous. Others arguably are, well in excess of the gift limitations that we have had in the past, let alone the ones that we've got currently. So it isn't an easy fix unless you do a broad-based exemption. I will argue that rodeo is culture. It's entertainment. It's art. You know, so the question isn't just performance art in a theatrical setting. It's a lot of other stuff, too. So I think we're going to need some help and some thoughtful consideration to make this, to return some reasonableness into the equation, always reminding ourselves that we created the unreasonableness with our enactment and the gift limitations.
Yeah. Any additional questions or statements? Sure. Yes, Senator Byrd.
Do you think it would be, because I frankly don't know how this distinction between entertainment and gifts came about, but do you think that would solve the problem, is just define them however we define gifts? Right now it's $50. Do you think for most of the things that you do, and again, I've participated in many of your offerings, and they're just treasures for the community. And the more people who can see them, the better, even children of lepers. I mean, public officials. So do you think that would solve the problem?
You know, you mentioned I guess in answer to your question, you mentioned two areas that I think are worth discussing. One is that there seems to be fairly distinct difference between commercial entertainment and essentially not-for-profit arts organizations. So that may be something that you may or may not be able to get into. Clearly, when we're inviting somebody, some of you, some of your families, to be our guest for a performance, we make very inexpensive tickets available. We have $10 rush tickets available many nights for people who would like to be able to see our performances and can't otherwise afford it. We can certainly value the tickets that we make available to you like those $10 rush tickets. I think there's a big difference between getting a $20 contribution from an arts organization that is doing a lot of really important work versus getting a $2,000 contribution for a skybox to commercial entertainment venture. So how you deal with that, I'm not quite sure. I think we're here to say to you, for, you know, on behalf of all the arts organizations that are providing what we think are really important, not only entertainment but educational and outreach opportunities, they certainly should be set up in some way so that you, your families, your other peers, their families, children, and so forth, can be our guests as many other people we invite could be.
Well, I would just propose that if there could be a distinction between public officials attending these events purely as evaluation, if they are doing an evaluative task on the arts organizations where public funds have been invested, then those should be completely exempted. And then furthermore, because arts organizations are very good about engaging members of the community, that elimination of the distinction between entertainment and other gifts within the $50 limit would also be appropriate.
Thank you.
Okay. One of the areas that we're having some difficulty with, and at the insistence of quite a number of members, the chair has opened up the discussion on gifts. And it's part of that discussion, parties have questioned the number in terms of the limitation. But part of it is it's very significant issues in terms of gifts themselves and what's permissible, what's not permissible. And we're in a backdrop right now of sitting with a court case out there questioning the constitutionality of the gift limitation and questioning it, I believe, on the portion of the Oregon Constitution that has not to do only with freedom of speech but freedom of expression, broader term. Part of the problem with gifts is it's not just the entertainment issue, because the entertainment, you could make that change. But when you start to distinguish between types of entertainment, you would be start to distinguishing between different types of speech, which clearly we will get a legislative council opinion that says we are in violation of the Constitution. I just want to... I've said to members, I'm so deep into ethics, trying to make a law simple in terms of the complexity that is there is not an easy task. And I think we are going to do some things to make this easier to comply with, but some of that complexity is still going to be there, even if we, I mean, if we opened the door, which we could, and just said that there's no longer an exclusion on entertainment, but it is subject to the same limitation as other gifts, that would probably be fine. But if we started to distinguish between which types of entertainment would be permissible and which types would not, I think we'd be back right into a constitutional issue of us trying to distinguish between which type of speech, you know, is in a sense good speech and which type of speech is not good speech, which I think legislative counsel would tell us we can't do. So,
yeah, and forgive me if it came across that I was implying that you should exempt one or the other. That wasn't my point. I was just trying to respond to the question about what do we do about rodeos, what do we do about blazer tickets, and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, clearly I think it's reasonable. The $50 limit takes care of all of that.
Yeah.
You can't have access to a Blazers skybox for $50 or less. So yeah, that those things will take care of themselves under the guise of just doing it as entertainment. I think we're here to just speak to what we think is a really important public service that we provide to the community, and we don't want any of your community to be denied that.
Okay. Senator Ferry.
Mr. Chairman, there is a couple of things that also are, you know, help complicate this issue. Every one of the people in this chamber receive bushels of invitations every year. And if you apply the but-for rule, you're attending, you wouldn't get an invitation to this event but for the fact that you're in the legislature. It makes the gift, no matter how well-motivated the giver, it makes the gift suspect, because other than your service in the legislature, but for that fact, you probably wouldn't have been offered the ticket or the opportunity. It's intriguing that we should look at the nonprofit aspect, in the arts exemption if we created one. The problem with that is that nonprofit organizations will proliferate, and for-profit organizations will form auxiliaries. You know, if you create a loophole, it won't be long before trucks are driving through it. So it is a little more complicated. For instance, in your example, that the $50 gift limit will handle the blazer issue, but how many people can you stuff into a skybox? And, you know, if it's 30 and a skybox is $1,500, you could figure out a way to keep it under $50 per person. So, you know, there are issues that, you know, and I agree with the chairman. I think it might be as easy to define art as it is to create a simple, well-understandable exemption for performing.
Senator Metzger.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and I think Senator Farrelly points out is the real difficulty we have, as you mentioned, because every time you try to make things clearer, they have a tendency to get less clear. There's a number of approaches that we can do for this, and certainly they've been discussed before, one of which is the school of thought of rather than trying to define all these things that or limit things, that you have visibility and transparency and you report everything and let the public decide. And that's where I've always come down on it. You know, it's transparency. Let the public decide whether they think, you know, you're abusing a position, as opposed to trying to nuance, you know, something that, oh, this is regional arts, or, you know, the mayor of Portland is expected to go to the opening of a game when in the arena may be on the verge of disappearing. I mean, you would expect that, but then you get into all these nuances. The other thing is, Mr. Chair, as you know, the LC that, you know, that Mr. Hendricks is drafting for me to bring to the committee that I told you about is to deal with the issue from a different angle, and that is we do have the gift issue going before the circuit court, and much as we did with the PERS issue, what this legislation would do would be to fast-track whatever decision the circuit court makes directly to the Supreme Court, so that we would know where we stand, because the fact of the matter is the Supreme Court, the Attorney General, and Legislative Council have both in previous rulings and comments have said it is unconstitutional. So at least if we can get that ruling affirmed again, we'll know from the legislative body what's our next step, rather than trying to nuance what all of the legal and opinions of the past have said is probably not going to be upheld anyway. But we need to find a way to deal with the issue. And again, but trying to nuance it as, you know, the rodeo versus the performing arts, it just seems like an impossible task.
Any additional? Thank you very much.
Thank you. What if we just promise not to enjoy the performance?
Right. Yeah.
That may be as tough as defining art.
Ms. Hagedorn, did you wish to come forward?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, very quickly, Erica Hagedorn with Public Affairs Council here today on the Oregon Judges Association's behalf. Just very quickly, we have a -15 amendment just to bring forward that would include an emergency clause and also a clause that would require the OGEC to redact any information regarding family member or household member names of previously filed statements starting January of 2008. So, as you all know, judges in our society make some of the toughest decisions that some folks aren't always happy with, and they've come to testify before this committee regarding the threats they receive. So the urgency of this bill for them is of utmost importance. So we hope you'll consider that at whatever time you see fit.
Okay. Any questions? Just to let the committee know, I've actually had that amendment already drafted. We have a different dash amendment.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a question. So this would redact all of the listings of family members since the requirement went into effect?
That's right, January 1st of 2008, as I understood it from LC this morning.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Thompson?
Chance Thompson, with Democracy Reform Oregon, nonpartisan, not-for-profit group focused on governmental accountability and transparency, as well as increasing opportunities for participation in politics. So as an organization, we supported last session Senate Bill 10 and House Bill 2595, and participated in the process that led, that contributed to, particularly to 2595, but also significant parts of Senate Bill 10, which was the interim ethics work group of the Oregon Law Commission. So I was on the advisory committee to that effort. So there's a couple of four big picture points I want to get into and then get into the amendments. One is, I think the tenor of that whole interim work group discussion, and certainly the approach of my group, is predicated on advocacy for ethics reform, not, or should not be equated with thinking that elected and public officials do not already strive to serve in a manner very consistent with high standards. And I was really pleased that Salt Lake City paper did some polling this month, actually, in the wake of some abuses of public trust in that state. And even with a bunch of ethics violations being in the news there, those surveyed, 79% of them said they thought that public officials in Utah were ethical. So, you know, it's like even with that going on, people can kind of distinguish. But at the same time, 87% of those surveyed supported the forming of the main reform idea that's for Utah-specific reasons, you know, in play there, which is the formation of an independent ethics commission. So my hunch is that Oregon polling would be really similar. So I think it's really important to recognize that I think this demonstrates that people want the structures and the tools to monitor ethics and address violations, and that that doesn't mean that they think there are these huge problems out there, that it's part of having a civic society. The other thing is, as Senator Chair Devlin referred to, when I kind of first got into this, I did some looking back, and particularly the Oregonian archives that, you know, go back 20 years electronically, and there are just repeated themes. I mean, this is just, you know, it's faint comfort given, you know, the current issues, but, you know, looking back just really illustrates how these discussions kind of recycle, and that, you know, the how to get it right issues just really aren't new. One consistent theme that I wanted to refer to, because it was in last week's hearing, kind of an elephant under the rug kind of issue, relates to is what's going on just to really deal with the reporting, newspaper reporting in the fall of 2006 on the unreported trips to Hawaii. Is that that was like, I think, just a trigger point or a tipping point that the interim work group had been, you know, there was really always going to be a substantial discussion of ethics even before that, but that obviously influenced the discussion. But also, looking back, there just have been repeated stories about these reporting violations, with subsequent editorials expressing as much concern about the action as the reporting violation. It's also important to recognize that other steps are needed beyond Senate Bill 10 and House Bill 25. And another kind of elephant in the room issue that my organization is kind of focusing on is addressing how the stronger gift limits are undermined by current rules on use of campaign funds and the fact that Oregon political campaigns operate without any limit on the size or source of contributions. Now, in a perfect world, the contribution limits would have been addressed first, but, you know, better late than never. I am working to ensure the introduction of contribution limits legislation this session. And one aspect that the legislature has been criticized for in the context of, you know, dealing with these other things and not this issue relates to the pass-through component of use of campaign funds and the context to deal with that is in the contribution limits proposal. In terms of with the stronger gift limits, seeing certain kinds of expenditures show up on C&E reports, we're planning some analysis. It looks like that's indeed happening. Interestingly enough, given kind of a history of reporting from the lobbying side that hasn't resulted in triggering kind of identifying the, you know, perhaps the amount and legislator involved, there actually may be some opportunities to tweak some of the ORSTAR reporting requirements to kind of really get some of the transparency there. Finally, there are definitely aspects of Senate Bill 10 and House Bill 25 that are working. Ron Brisson's report last week, for example, one of the key issues is matching up so that the timelines for the lobbying and the lobbyist are the same, the quarterly timelines. And that is, you know, working to identify reporting lapses. And in that reporting area, the quarterly is making a lot of sense. The Oregon School Board Association has used a section of House Bill 25 related to, you know, an association-specific development of an ethics kind of training plan. And then obviously an increase in training in general, which has been referred to. So that's just some of the backdrop. Turning to the current bills, the whole issue of statements of economic interest were not, you know, one of our organizational priorities in the legislative history. And the House Bill 2595 language that added the listing of relatives on the SCIs, as I recall, came directly from the interim ethics work group that, you know, had a lot, very appropriately, a lot of local government representation. And that group definitely discussed, you know, this whole balance between transparency and burdensomeness. And, you know, on that, those points, you know, I took my cue on achieving that balance, you know, from the recommendations of the work group. Obviously, that balance hasn't been achieved, so fully support Senate Bill 30, as well as the Dash 15 amendments. I think that's actually a very important addition. In terms of the other amendments, the Dash 2, Dash 3, and Dash 4 amendments seem fine. With regards to the Dash 5 and Dash 9, kind of the more personal friend, definitely support, you know, the underlying goal, what that those amendments are trying to get at. Just again, a little bit of history. The reason that Senate Bill 10 did not include that kind of language, because there was some discussion of it, is because of thinking that that but-for framework adequately addressed this. And I know there's been some reference to other states having the personal friend provisions, and at least in several of the states, including Colorado, which gets talked about, part of the reason that's in there is because there's not that kind of but-for framework. At the same time, so that's just like a point, you know, a history. You know, it's like there's some reason why it wasn't there originally. I think there's some equally good reasons that it's being considered now. And I think it's just really important to take a look at it in terms of, is it administratable? And for example, when then Representative Merkley kind of talked about this point, you know, he had some comments along the lines of Senator Farioli's last time. It's like, you know, this is just really not going to be feasible. So on that score, I'm not sure that the amendments are, you know, quite where they need to be, but definitely support this overall concept that there's no interest in having these rules, you know, affect those kinds of dynamics. I believe it's in the Dash 1 amendments. As I mentioned, the shift to quarterly and kind of matching up the lobbyist and lobbying entity, that quarterly emphasis really makes sense there.
Can I interrupt you there?
Sure.
And I'm not trying to get a lot of questions at this time, so I'd like you to finish the presentation.
Yeah.
But just to address that issue of matching up, difficulty in this is that that matching up is largely for the 90 members in this building and statewide officials. not the thousands of people that will be required under the current law to actually do the quarterlies. There are a few jurisdictions that actually have their own lobby reporting, but they're quite few in the state other than the state. So,
I think I have a suggestion that's going to get at that. So you'll tell me if I don't. But in the context of the SCI and the requirement for SCI filers, that those pool of people, to also have that quarterly report, I remember discussions in the work group that the SCI, you know, that certain timings make sense in some places, but that the SCI timing should be annual. So I, quite frankly, when this issue came up about, you know, somehow dealing with a number of SCI filers who, for whom, like, that quarterly reporting is, you know, isn't kind of hitting the mark, I had to kind of go back and think through, now, why was that in there? So I would, and my understanding is it ended up that element being quarterly because of just the issues that people face, like, oh, am I going to remember something at the end of the year that happened at the beginning of the year? But I think my suggestion on that, instead of the idea of if the report is zero, to not report at all, that actually, I think, puts the commission into a tricky position, because if they don't get a report, does it mean it was zero, or does it mean somebody is not reporting something? So I would argue that to make the what's currently being asked for on a quarterly basis, shift that to annual and just include it as part of the SCI.
Yeah.
And to the extent that, you know, one of the, you know, dredging out of my memory banks, you know, what was, you know, that piece, why was that piece quarterly, did seem to be related to, you know, the whole, am I going to remember? It seems like, in the current paper reporting paradigm that we're still in, I mean, the Ethics Commission could almost, like, send in a log, you know, or like a little log sheet, you know, you keep track of this. And once it shifts to electronic reporting, people could go in to their, you know, records and report that information, so they're kind of keeping track of it along the way. But, you know, if they wanted to do that, that was, you know, a convenience for them.
Yeah.
But that's my thought on Senate Bill 1. And then
I think along those same lines, though, one of the things that, just for the committee, I think they all know this, but just to understand, is we've been looking at this issue on quarterly reports quite a bit. And one of the difficulties with the measure that we put forward in terms of only filing if you had something to report is the relationship that might have to the penalty structure. Because if somebody inadvertently doesn't report something on a first quarter, what they could potentially owe in a penalty at the end would be very substantial. However, the other thing to keep in mind is between the SCI and the quarterly report, the four questions that are asked in the quarterly report are unique to the quarterly report. There's nothing in the SCI relative to those questions. So if you move those four into the annual SCI, you could have all the reporting, you know, in one report and basically eliminate the quarterlies.
That's my suggestion as well, Chair Devlin.
Okay.
Then the final comment, it relates to some of the earlier testimony, and again, just a little bit of history. As opposed to just incorporating entertainment under the gift limit, the ban I would characterize as an 11th hour amendment to Senate Bill 10 in the House. And what's that line, you know? Legislation and sausage making. I mean, sometimes 11th hour amendments probably save the day. I would not characterize this one in that way. And some of the scenarios I described to people were along these lines, you know, with plays and complimentary tickets. Unfortunately, at that point, it was only in work session, so that, you know, there was no opportunity to testify in opposition. But I will do so now. It just seems like that introduces an unneeded anomaly in the law, and, you know, just making, you know, I would would concur with previous testimony about just kind of doing away with that distinction and how the gift limit is evaluated. And then in conjunction with the dash 2 amendments that more clearly identify when a public official is there representing a governmental body, I mean, maybe that might do it as is, but maybe that could be tweaked a little bit more to, you know, address some of the early testimony as well. So that's it for me. Thanks.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I asked the same question last week of Mr. Burson. We've had this in effect now for over a year, and you're very close to the situation, as Mr. Burson is. Can you give us some concrete examples of how ethics have improved in Oregon because of this law?
I would, Senator Burdick, Chair Devlin, I would go to the increased level of training
probably
that has resulted. There was some testimony last week about training, like, for example, within the city of Portland. There's a city commission that I attend a lot of, most all the meetings in Portland, and, you know, so I happen to be, you know, sit in on that training. And many of the questions that came up actually related to concerns that and issues that predated Senate Bill 10. So the Senate Bill 10 seemed to have triggered that training, but I would argue that that training, you know, and should have been done all along and would have been helpful all along. So I would really point to the training as reflecting a major emphasis from the interim work group, which is really just trying to provide resources for folks. Kind of like what I said at the very beginning, kind of referring to that polling, even if it's from Utah, its applicability here, that, you know, people want those tools and they want to do the right thing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to follow up, I mean, we've heard hour after hour of testimony from many local officials and other people about how burdensome this is. We've had actual whole planning commissions quit over this. So what I'm looking for is the other side. I mean, this was put into effect to include the ethics, and Mr. Burson also mentioned the training, mm-hmm. which, of course, could have occurred in under the old law. I'm looking for something that has happened differently under the actual provisions of this new law that would make it worth all this extra effort, all the money that's being spent, and all the disruption in many of our communities.
Chair Devlin, Senator Burdick, back to, I mean, part of the reason I also kind of introduced, you know, just this history and the difficulty of how to get it right. The particularly troublesome provisions related to the addition of listing relatives on the statement of economic interest was, you know, came right from the work group process that had lots of local government representation, and I think it just underscores the difficulty that they didn't hit the mark, and so that's why I support removing those amendments or removing those provisions with the Senate Bill 30 and its amendments.
So, Mr. Chairman, just to close the loop, and I'm not going to continue haranguing you, but I still haven't heard anything that you can name positive about this, and you were, you know, one of the chief advocates of it, and I just am looking for something that we might have gained from all this after a year on the books, and I'm not hearing anything.
Chair Devlin, Senator Burdick, I think the, again, I'll just repeat, the training, the improvements in the lobbying reporting, and that these, so I think there are examples.
Yeah. I do think there's another issue here, though, too, and that is that the deeper that you get into this, you start to realize that part of the problem was not alone, just SB 10. Part of the problem was, as we got into this deeper because of this focus, we found problems in the existing law. I mean, I think that's what's led to a lot of the issues that the Ethics Commission has had, is that nobody had ever focused on these issues to this level. And when they started to focus, they saw flaws in the existing law. So, Senator Atkinson.
This isn't a question, but maybe for the committee. I'd like to see the maybe staff could help us see the old law and the improvements that were made on one piece of paper. And she just made a comment that it's harder on lobbyists or the lobbyists reporting. I think lobbyists have got off this whole thing scot-free. The burden of proof is on, you know, the lepers. Yeah. It's not on lobbyists. Lobbyists that do wrong to a politician, give them bad advice, get raises. This is, I'd like the clarification on lobbyists reporting more, because I've never heard
that. Mm-hmm. I think what we could do, Senator Atkinson, is we could do a comparison between what that law put forward and how we are changing it. We could do that. The problem that I have seen in this is I actually had thought once about a week or two ago about going back and revising the chapter that this is in. And the problem is SB 10 was an overlay on that chapter. In a sense, it didn't go in and be a broad brush and basically take it out and put something in. It was an overlay. It's 32 pages long, addressing some issues that we haven't even touched upon here. So I think what we're in a situation now of is we can do the comparisons between what SB 10 did, what this did, but it's going to be probably a future session of the legislature that goes back in and tries to add clarity to that whole chapter, because there are so many issues in that chapter that we haven't even talked about, that were not part of SB 10, and that, you know, affect some unique areas. I would encourage anyone who wants to go and look at that chapter in ORS. It is, if you print it off, it's 32 pages long. I don't know how long it's in the book, actually.
Sure.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we just fix it now?
Well, because I have about a month left to fix it, and if we open up all those other areas that's in it, we would be here probably at least till June before we'd have a draft to send to the House.
Well, doesn't that scream for us to, number one, do that, and number two, make it simple?
Senator Atkinson, I will engage you in a debate. Go and read the 32 pages of it. And then come back. Yes, Senator Ferriola.
Mr. Chairman, as you wisely corrected me earlier, I'm the only retread on the committee.
Yeah.
And I would like to add some support for what I've been hearing from Senator Burdick. I think it would benefit the committee to know what new outcomes can we point to that are specific as a result of the passage of the legislation that couldn't have been achieved under the existing law. And I'll point out that if the catalyst for this were the unreported trips to Hawaii, that every one of those things were undertaken and adjudicated under the previous law and fully disclosed. So arguably, this is an argument that came back from the people that were observing the process and those directly involved, the law was working. People were disciplined. People were required to report. And a better understanding of the reporting requirements, including the issue of aggregation, came out of that prior to the passage of Senate Bill 10. So I guess I would say that I'm hearing Senator Burdick ask a very simple but very profound question, which is, what's the benefit, what's the product that's come from SB 10? And the idea that we have more reporting because we made a complex nightmare and required 30,000 forms to be filed certainly would indicate we need more training. So I don't know whether you point that out as a benefit or a symptom. So, you know, I would like to see staff undertake the issue with as much help as you possibly can get and put a side-by-side comparison up to what did we have before the passage of SB 10? What do we have now that we couldn't have achieved prior to the passage of SB 10? And I think your list will be
Interesting.
Well, I think we can do some comparison of SB 10 and what we're doing, and in comparison to the rest of the law. I would actually say that we have a very limited period of time to get this work done.
And, Mr. Chairman, to that issue specifically, if we don't like the paint on the side of the house, we don't need to tear the house down to change the color.
Yeah.
So I don't know about, you know, undertaking a rewrite of the entire section might be a little ambitious.
Yeah. Okay. With that, thank you very much. We are adjourned till Thursday, but again, Thursday is subject to the session is
if
the Senate is on the floor.
Is it?
No.
What the hell? Have I got two of everything? Oh, no, I separate.